Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
I don't know if there's a whole lot more to talk about just children in general, but I know, Jefferson, you had some something you definitely wanted to bring up in the podcast about raising daughters, and so maybe moving into the question more specifically related to women in the church. Do you want to go ahead and throw that one to us?
Yeah, so for me, part of my reexamination of the church, like, really has, and it's not so much based on the based on Kate Kelly or even ordained women. It just, as I started to reconsider the church, I thought, you know, I'm having this baby girl, and I had always just thought of the church as a man. And I realized, you know, what, and I sat around as a missionary with my companions and stuff, right? The conversation would be like, how many wives are you going to have? And those kind of very immature, obviously, conversations. But as I've matured and thought about those same conversations, I thought, well, what does the church actually have to offer for women going forward? You know, what is the church actually promising women for the eternities? What, I mean, they've tried to reshape it a little bit, I think, from, you know, you're just basically, I hate to be crude about it, but eternal baby maker. You know, there's been sort of more of an emphasis on the priests and priestesses kind of thing, and more of a equal partners. But I'm not sure though that all of the church history or the scriptures or, you know, or past prophets have actually really articulated something that I think is worthwhile enough that I'm like, maybe I should get out just for my daughter alone. So, I don't know. I felt like it would be an excellent time, especially that having Nylon on the podcast to ask something like this. So, yeah, that's basically my question. Well, can either of you articulate something that you feel is there, not just that you feel is actually there, that I'm missing?
Well, I think that there are really two questions, and I think you're looking at one part of it, which is, you know, what sort of perspective does it offer my daughter in terms of her eternal identity? But I think that there's a very real other part of that, which is, you know, what does membership in the church offer my daughter here, you know, in her lived experience? And I think that, you know, considering both of those are really, you know, rich areas, I think, I'll start with the eternal perspective just because that seems to be what you're dwelling on in your question. I think for me, as I've looked at other faith communities' doctrines, there's really... we're really the only Western religion that I know of that, even though it's not well documented and spelled out, believes in a female deity. And I take that back. It is somewhat well documented. It's just not deep. It's kind of wide, but not deep. You know, there was a paper that came out from BYU Studies a couple years ago that documented... David Paulson was the primary author that documented all of the references to Heavenly Mother, and there are a lot of them. I mean, hundreds of them. It's not a deep knowledge, but you know, I think even recently I've been hearing more and more lay members refer to our heavenly parents. And of course, the, you know, much has been made of the fact that the family, a proclamation to the world, uses the term heavenly parents. And this idea that, you know, men and women are codependent upon each other, interdependent upon each other for exaltation, I think has a very beautiful, positive spin to it. I also think that books like Beverly Campbell's Eve and The Choice Made in Eden have really shaped the conversation over the past 20 years that confirms a very positive gender doctrine around the eternal goal, eternal potential of women. And I mean, it is incomplete. It's definitely incomplete, and there's so much more we want to know. However, I think in comparison to some of the alternatives that are out there, I think it offers a really rich foundation. It is by no means all the answers, and I think any speculation about eternal baby making is just kind of silly. The answer is we simply don't know. But I do think that what we do know, for me, offers a tremendous wealth of possibility that simply isn't even being explored in other Western religions. And so I think that's something that I've learned to appreciate for the good and leave the questions unanswered on the rest of it. And in terms of the lived experience...
Can we kill it in doctrine just a little bit before we move back? Because I agree there was two parts to the question. So
yeah.
Jefferson and I don't know, Adam, I can't remember if you have any daughters or anything like that. Do you guys agree that the Heavenly Mother doctrine, Divine Feminine, is constructive and helpful and something positive?
Well, for me, so yeah, I do have a daughter. She's going to be two next month. I just in thinking of that doctrine, I mean, I've been a member of the church for 14 years, and it's definitely not preached from the pulpit, I guess, in the 14 years since I've been a member of the church. And I guess it's one of those, we don't speak about her because she's too reverent.
Yeah,
it's,
well, there's all that bad reasoning, yeah. But yeah. Are you hearing it more often? Because I am, like Nylan said, I'm hearing it more often lately.
Yeah.
I think I am. I mean, and I definitely think that in my conversations with my wife, I think we view each other as equals eternally, I guess, when we talk on that level, and maybe that's because of the discourse that we hear in church. So, you know, on a personal level, I actually, you know, and my wife growing up in Young Women's, and she loved Young Women's, and she always thought of herself as a daughter of God and an equal to me and this kind of thing. So on a personal level, I don't think that we see it extremely limited. However, I recognize, you know, from other friends and people that may be in a similar situation as me that, you know, this kind of, you know, the discussion really is more of a, the wife is going to be, you know, the helpmeet to the husband. The husband's going to be the guy and the wife's going to be there to support the husband in eternity, you know, but that's kind of the, I mean, I guess I can recognize.
Yeah, well, that's the cultural interpretation of what help meet means and all that. And of course, if we as a church ever get around to having a more open view towards scripture and looking at Genesis and all that kind of stuff, a la the podcast that I've been doing, that series with those guys, that stuff goes away pretty quickly, but it is certainly ingrained. And so many women for so long have felt like that's their role. And so it's hard to even get them to move off it.
It absolutely is, but I think for me, you know, there are some uncomfortable parts in the temple for women, but one of the things that really strikes me in the temple is that the relationship between Adam and Eve is defined in its terms after the fall. And, you know, I don't know of a lot of theological exploration, but for me, I am very comfortable with the idea that the relationship between the genders that we experience now may be very, very different from what it was pre-fall and from what it will be when we return and see the way Heavenly Father and Heavenly Mother work together. That's always kind of sat well with me. And I don't, I haven't seen anything that actually says, you know, the way we interact with as genders today is a result of the fall and it's merely an earthly condition. But I don't know, you know, like I said, we know very little about it. So that's a possibility in my mind.
Okay. As far as the doctrine thing goes, it seems like the brethren were very happy to offer all kinds of explanations about the way women would be in the eternities during the polygamous period. But nowadays, nothing's being offered, really. I mean, and they're not even offering the explanation that Adam suggested, which is the somewhat folkloric idea that the mother God is too sacred to talk about, you know, unless they're being pushed about it in an interview by Mike Wallace or whatever. You know, they're not, you know, why aren't they pontificating about it now? I mean, it just seems like they're not willing to lead on this. And, you know, so we're left with what, in even when Mother God or gods are discussed, it's always, or the ones that what we have is kind of not something we always want to lay claim to. So, you know what I'm saying? It's more chauvinistic in nature.
I think Mother in Heaven right at this point is what we individually want to make of her. And because I think there simply is nothing. And so I don't know that there's a lack of responsibility, you know, or irresponsibility on the part of our leaders. I think that's just sort of a subject that sort of defies even speculation because there's so little information. But that's not to say that I think if it's important to people, they can develop a relationship with her and seek her out or seek out some sort of divine feminine. You know, for me personally, I think...
Do we end up excommunicated for it? I'm sorry.
Not at all. I think what I'm talking about is something that happens on a very personal level of worship. You know, for example, the most recent issue of Exponent 2 has some lovely descriptions of people feeling close to the divine feminine when they're practicing yoga or when they're, you know, singing a particular hymn in a certain way, I think, you know, there's a lot of room for meditating in a certain way. I think there's a lot of room for us, you know, to be seeking things that are meaningful in other ways. There isn't one prescribed way to develop a relationship with her, and so I think people are seeking for ways. You know, there might be a lot of reward in sort of seeking after God as a plural. In our standard ways, you know, of looking for her in the scriptures. I know one woman who has actually just written a book about the idea that the feminine divine is found in the scriptures and the personification of wisdom and beauty and, you know, charity and all of this. And she actually has done a lot of study into the actual translation process of the original Bible and looked at, you know, how those things ended up being so gendered and how the description of childbirth is so prevalent in the scriptures and what does that mean and what is it trying to tell us through the female imagery. And I think that for her, that's particularly a meaningful way of worshiping the feminine divine. For me personally, you know, I grew up with an active, very, you know, devout mother. And I had a much more difficult relationship with my father, and he was not active. And so for me, the need, the divine relationship was one of a male God. I needed that. I didn't need another mother in my life because I was very close to my mother. I had a terrific mother. And so, you know, I think I've heard a lot of stories since, you know, though, that in which it was reversed, you know, and there was a lack of a mother figure. And some people have successfully found some sort of connection to the divine feminine in their own ways. It's definitely an uncharted territory. But I don't know of anybody being disciplined for it. I mean, certainly there were requests not to pray. I mean, I remember President Hinckley specifically requested that we not pray to Heavenly Mother in the public sphere.
Yeah, and that was in the early 90s. Yeah, when I was at Claremont for sure.
But what about like a doctrine that shapes for women, what your role will look like? You know, I just feel like, right, for men, we have this there's a lot of information about what you'll be doing. And there's just not as much information there. So,
I guess that's great, right?
I can speculate anything I would like. But at the same time, it just sometimes just feels like, you know, that's really right. That's the role of the brethren. They should be laying this stuff out if it's there. So, I'm holding you guys accountable for something that's really not you're not accountable for it. But
I would just return to the idea that you know, I think we have so much deep information that I don't know, I don't feel it's accountability that it's a responsibility for our leaders or for God to be revealing more than we have now. I feel like we have, you know, there's an excitement for me about knowing just enough that I can, you know, make decisions and be accountable for my decisions and have hope in the future. But I don't have to know everything, I guess. I'm at peace with that.
And I think we know a heck of a lot more about the male stuff too. Especially if you're going to go to scriptures, there's such little there. It's all the gist of this. The plan of salvation has a sense of enlargement. We have a sense that any divine going forward is a male and female together. All that stuff about making babies and even eternal gendered spirits. That's pretty speculative stuff. Taylor Petrie's article in Dialogue a few years ago, I did a podcast on that. I can link to that. I know that Sam Brown just did something in BYU Studies in the last year that also kind of challenged the whole business of, you know, babies and that God's family grows through procreation versus adoption and other different kinds of methods and things like that. I'm not sure if an electronic copy will be available for that, but I'll certainly post it if it is. So I have a feeling this idea of, you know, we have so much information, that's a little bit overstating, but also I'm so glad because you kind of early on, Jefferson, said, you know, they're no longer saying all the stuff that they had that they were saying during the polygamous era, thank goodness. And so I'm glad for this to be a period in which women's voices, I mean, we can't stop this. This is happening now. We are going to see women's influence increase. And I'd rather have them really get to know what women's voices offer, what women's perspectives offer, the women's leadership gifts and things like this. And before they ever start speculating or before they ever start even seeking guidance on this, I want them to ask the best questions. And I'm perfectly fine with this being a time in which the question is being seeded and slowly growing in hearts and whatnot before we get somebody to say something and set us back 10 years or more.
But it is a little bit sad that we're saying, thank goodness they're not speaking. And also,
well, they're not speaking when they're not ready to speak because these questions are unfortunately pretty new for them. We can play the blame game or not, but it's the fact. These guys, it's not on their agenda when they go to work in the morning because it's usually they all have an assignment within some department and this, that, and the other thing, and you know, to sit there and they don't take a month off to ponder theology each year, you know, or do those
that,
kinds of
that
things.
That might be awesome, but if they did. But I think in our initial phone conversation, I said how sometimes it's a little bit, I don't know, disappointing to me that it seems like the most thoughtful version of our religion is coming from voices that seem like they're outside of the leadership of the church. from Nylon and Dan's voice, or from these other people you spoke with or spoke about, and are most of the people that end up on the podcast aside from me. And, you know, it's just, I don't know, that, you know, I think this might have even frustrated me, you know, in the civil rights era, that I probably would have been pounding my fist saying, why isn't my church at the lead of this? Why is it this other church when, you know, why is our truth not motivating all these people to do this, to, you know, solve this problem, when instead it seemed like we were on the other end? Once again, I may be getting, well, you might want to cut all this out, but, you know, that frustrates people, especially, I guess, people who are, I don't know, progressive or liberally minded or whatever word you want to use, you know, who aren't always happy with the status quo. And I would, before, I really would like to get Nylon to talk about, though, being a woman in the church, and maybe at least relieve me that my daughter will not feel.
Well, partly, do you sort of sense, Jefferson, that if you as a parent are super informed and you know what's doctrine, what's speculation, what's, you know, kind of the nature of things, and if you as a dad have been super informed, you know, again, maybe this is a make or break, a stay or leave issue for you, but the more informed you are, the more that you're ready for this, don't you think you'll be far more influential on her than bad teaching at church?
Oh, yes. I think I'm going to be much better off than my father was, or even my mother was for my sisters. So.
I mean, one of the wonderful things is that, you know, I think that we shouldn't de-emphasize or forget that, you know, if you want further light and knowledge on this, you know, it might only come to you in a sense of peace about it, or a sense that there is an answer that you're not familiar with already, but you have the opportunity to ask about this too, you know. And one thing that I love is that, you know, I think when you say that you find other people more interesting than our leaders, there are people who, like me, I spend so much time thinking about this one particular subject that I've asked a lot about it and I've studied a lot about it. And I don't think that our leaders are discouraging individual members from truly, you know, pondering these things and finding out answers and coming to peace with them themselves. And I do believe that we can receive sort of that further light and knowledge on a specific subject if that is really important to us. And I don't, like I said, you know, it may not be like a sort of factual learning, but it may be a sense of peace that there's an answer that we don't know yet. And I truly believe that. And I don't know, you know, I know, as Dan was saying, you know, it's a large church now, and we have, you know, truly 12 and 15, leaders who are managing this global church. And I think one of the testaments to me of the divinity of the church is that it is a worldwide global organization that's led by lay membership. And in contrast to so many other denominations where, you know, people are individually church planting and being responsible for their own local flock, where there's not a lot of coordination between all of the different congregations, I just think, for me, I'm constantly sort of in awe that it was, you know, this global organization works as it does, because, you know, I think that the brethren are probably being briefed as much on ordained women as they are the crisis in the Crimea, and, you know, so I feel like there's a lot of responsibility on me and on all of us as members to seek for those answers that really hit it, what we need individually. And I feel like I've received a lot of that, those answers, and I received a lot of peace to the answers that I don't have now.
Maybe as a perspective that I have, and, you know, again, I was not raised in an LDS home, and I didn't go through, you know, parents who were raising children in the Spencer W. Kimball time frame. It, you know, I have read, you know, my share of history and you know, teachings from the prophets and these types of things as well. And not to diminish, you know, other people's pains that they feel, and also recognizing that maybe I come from privilege being a man, or definitely that I come from privilege being a man. I guess for me on this issue of eternal things, I don't necessarily know what I'm being taught at church that men may have more than women, because I think part of it for me, I guess, is how I view the church over the last, again, 14 years being a member of the church. I can see some of the, maybe what I would see is old-fashioned gender roles still being perpetuated, maybe part of the lived experience of the church, maybe more to the second part of that question, as opposed to the eternal. I've never been taught, you know, that men were going to have this. You know, I've read that, obviously, you know, some of the things that, that were discussed early in the early days of the church. But as far as what I'm being taught now, you know, that's not to diminish some pains that other people feel. But part of the question that I have is, you know, sometimes I feel like, especially compared to what I had outside of the church, that we are somewhat progressive. I feel like that, you know, we kind of empower women, at least compared to what I had outside of the church. And I, just when I think that we're making quite a bit of progress, you know, right now I actually just started teaching in primary for the first time in my life, and we were in sharing time and we were singing the new song. I think it's God Gave Us Families. And
oh, and part we're skipping of that is, the second and third verse in my word.
Yeah, that's, I mean, and my wife, she goes through the whole, you know, she explains to people, well, the Proclamation of the Family says the primary purpose for, you know, of women, the part, you know, she focuses on the word primary, saying that women can do a lot of things, but their primary purpose may be to care for children. And then we go to church and I'm singing right next to my son or whatever that, you know, a father's job is to preside and to provide, and a woman's job is to care and prepare. So I guess I struggle as far as the lived experience. I can still see that, again, you know, as a man coming from, you know, the privilege of being a man and not fully recognizing that. I view my daughter, and I say, man, I really hope that the church speeds up our progression on these issues so that we can see that, you know, my daughter can not have to feel as if her, you know, purpose, not primary purpose, but purpose is to bear children, and the man's primary purpose is to go make money.
Yeah, thank you. Are we ready to jump more into the lived stuff now, Nylan? Do you want to jump into some of that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that the lived experience for me is the source of frustration much more than any of what I consider to be a very, you know, comparatively robust and incredibly glorious, you know, eternal vision. The lived experience is where I feel that we have a lot of work to do. That said, I will start with an anecdote that I've always remembered. A friend of mine joined the church in college when she was about 20 years old, and I was talking to her about this one day, and I said, you know, what about some of the struggles that we have in our young women's messages? And she said, Nylan, like, you know, you never had to be a teenage girl without the church. And I've always remembered that, and her point was just, you know, that there are different but equally profound and equally damaging forces in the life of a teenage girl outside the church. That said, I think that, you know, our particular struggles are manifest in some statistics that I've been kind of working through recently, which are that Utah has one of the lowest graduation rates for female college students in the country. More of our female students drop out than most other states. You know, we have a very poor representation in government. There are we're number 46 in the number of women in our state legislature. You know, so and these statistics go on and on. And so so there's this sort of conundrum for me, which is, well, we have this glorious promise that's more robust than any other Western tradition of sort of what a female independent of her husband and with her husband can become. And yet, as you were saying in the, from the song, there are these very prescribed roles. And I've thought about this a lot. And, you know, I think there's this transition that's happening right now where we have felt in the past that in order to teach priorities and values and principles, those have to be couched in what those priorities, values, and principles look like. So they look, you know, when you say prioritize family, it looks like a stay-at-home mom, right? And the church is just too big now and too global, and there are too many cultural influences coming from various members to prescribe what that looks like now. And so we're in this process of teaching now, you know, prioritize family, but we have to teach it based on what that feels like and what that's right in every single individualized circumstance. And we're struggling with that. There's no doubt about it. And, you know, I had nothing to do with not teaching verses 2 and 3 in my primary, but I was very relieved we did because the statistics in that I've also been studying show that the number one factor for LDS girls here in Utah to go to college and finish college and go on even to graduate school and to careers is their parents and their local bishop and young women's leaders. So, you know, for girls who are receiving messages, strong messages at home about how they not only need to pursue an education, but they need to complete an education, and they need to complete that education so that they can be fulfilled and make money and take advantage of a long life with many different eras in it, only a few of which include
the childbearing ones,
children.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Then those messages will come through, and we can change that culture in our homes. That's the encouraging part of that. Is the data really shows that that has a huge impact. And if we work with, you know, their local primary and young women's leaders, I think we can really change that. But that more than the eternal impact is what I'm particularly concerned about. That said, I think that, you know, I went to an all-girls school for 13 years, and I love, since my children are not having that opportunity, I love the opportunity that they have to have a protected space in which to develop their voices as girls. And I think we really underestimate the power of that and the importance of that in a young girl's life these days, that girls are different than boys, and they do benefit from an emphasis on feminine strength and feminine qualities. And I'm not talking about, you know, motherhood and what's your wedding dress going to look like. I'm talking about real safe spaces for dialogue, for expressing fears, for expressing hope, for being encouraged about their future visions of themselves. And I think that if that's done in the right way, a sphere for girls' development is actually a phenomenal thing.
I really appreciate what Nyland had to say about how we kind of need to change the language from these are the things we should be our focus, and less away from this is the way it looks like when these things are your focus, because it can look so many different ways. My mother worked, and I know 100% that she worked because her focus was her family, you know, and
exactly.
So people don't, that's not really accounted for. I mean, obviously it would be difficult to account for in a three-verse primary song, but, you know, you could just eliminate it, and then you never have to try to shape it in any way. But, sorry, go ahead, Adam.
Yeah, you know, if I could, you know, maybe even just to give a little plug. So my wife and I, we just purchased your book, Nylon, and I've only read maybe 30 pages of it, so I apologize, I haven't read the whole thing, but I will. And she has been reading it, and I think maybe even to the first part of the podcast where we discussed, you know, living authentically, what do you have to do to be a Mormon? I think, you know, clearly, you know, it focuses on the experiences of women, but also it's this, you know, broad inclusive way of thinking that's not so rigid, where, you know, not everybody has to be uniform, not everybody has to be, you know, if we had more of this kind of dialogue, more of this discourse going on at church, then even, you know, as a man struggling to say, how could I be a Mormon and not think this way and not do things in this bubble? And I really appreciate that from what I've read thus far in your book. And I know my wife is actually reading it right now.
Okay.
Meanwhile, you're talking on Skype with us. She's reading it right in the same room.
Oh, she's not in the same room. She's actually
in the
other
room. Very cool. That's wonderful.
One of the things I loved doing when I was writing the book was actually noticing how often our leaders do talk. They do encourage us to look beyond the trappings and the formalities and those practices that are supposed to indicate where our priorities are. And, you know, Elder Dorf is sort of the master of this right now, right? And he has some wonderful statements that I did use in the book about how can we judge each other? We're all leaves growing out of the same tree, but you know, the tree unifies us, but each of us is an individual leaf. And they really talk about, you know, and I think if you look to the temple too, there's this principle of beauty and variety in creation, right? That things are created to give beauty and variety to the earth. And those two are linked. The beauty comes from the variety. And I am very encouraged that I think, especially Elder Uchtdorf, but also there have been some statements that I used in the book from Elder Holland too, and President Osterson is really hammering home with this, with the Relief Society right now. They really, the rhetoric is very, very inclusive right now. And so I think that's very encouraging. And I love being able to sort of point to some of those official statements and say, look, you know, we can be our own worst enemies in terms of emphasizing these stereotypes. And there's a lot, there's permission or just encouragement from our leaders to not be so tied to those things.
Very cool. You know, ultimately, guys, for me, you know, the whole goal of life is to become spiritually independent anyway. You know, there's Jesus, the famous thing, you know, the question that he poses, was man made for the Sabbath, or is the Sabbath made for man? And we need to be asking ourselves that same question in regard to the church. Is the church here to help us in our journey, or are we and everything we're to do is for the purposes of serving the church in terms of, you know, keeping its cultural cred going and things like that? Heck no. The church is there to be a help to us, but ultimately, just like with the law of Moses or any of the laws and the commandments, they're to become dead unto us. We're to become, you know, alive in Christ ourselves, to where we don't need any external law and things like this. And so even in these early stages with our teenage girls and as we move towards adulthood, the goal for me is to simply, you know, give opportunities for people to work with the Spirit, to gain that confidence on their own, to where they're not constantly looking over their shoulder. So I looked at my daughter, who, you know, just happened to be called to pretty much all the presidencies growing up through Young Women's, and she was always on the Bishop's Youth Councils, and she learned to speak in a group, and she learned to mix it up and to have her ideas, and she learned how to get those things across. And so, you know, by eighth grade, she was in student government. By the time she was a senior in high school, she and her best friend, also a woman, you know, ran the school. She just completed a 2-year leadership program at Utah Valley University, and now she's vice president of that program this year. And I think all of this came because of the robustness of, you know, not because of it. I mean, that was certainly a contributing factor, and it doesn't mean that women don't, you know, do this sorts of stuff without the Mormon church there. But boy, there's so much good stuff there that I think if we're living and modeling in our own marriages and our own relationships with women, you know, this equal partnership and your voice is valued and heard, I mean, to me, you know, this is one of those things where the church can be of service to us rather than us feeling like our soul is sucked away because of some vague cultural set of beliefs right now. You know, we're going to move the church forward as we move forward stronger, spiritually independent, and, you know, confident.
That's beautiful, Dan. I totally agree. And I think, you know, our goal as parents of young women is to correct the few messages that are going to come through that we feel don't support their eternal identity. But our job is not to sort of tear down all the goodness that does come from the program, right? And which is exactly what I think you're saying. And I think the encouraging thing, as I said earlier, is that, you know, data has shown that we have that power, right? So there is so much good in the program, and we have the power to out sort of balance out the negative.
Yeah, and Jefferson, I'm kind of bugging you, or I'm picking on you a little bit, because, you know, when you, I know that it's everybody your own question, your own journey, but, you know, if you leave the church, then there's one less, you know, guy alerted to this, you know, doing his part, you know, and raising a strong daughter within this church to teach us,
yeah.
You know. So, I mean, you know, I don't want anybody to stay because of that. But, you know, unless the church is going to explode and go away, we know it's going to be influential in lots of lives. And if our model is there's a lot of pain here, yet, you know, I know Mormonism is going to continue to go on, you know, I just as soon have it be the best version of Mormonism it can. And that's, you know, that includes people like us who are, you know, have the time, like Nyland was saying, you know, we're not totally focused on everything else, because, you know, and we can pick our subjects and we can go deeper and things on them and sometimes be, you know, slightly ahead of, you know, pushing the envelope or something. But, I don't know. I'm just kind of talking there, but I want every, you know, again, within Mormon Matters listeners, I think you kind of know that I'm pro Mormon. I'm pro people staying if they can, but of course, you know, we've got to gain that spiritual footing ourselves so that we can be strong within it.
Yeah, I it gets difficult though sometimes, right, to be the defender of what you think is right, when sometimes, I mean, I think what, like Nyland and her from the previous conversation about your conversation about dress and attire, and happened to say, hey, wait a minute, we need to rethink this, how we're, you know, we may be blaming victims by saying someone's dressed wrong or those kind of things, you know. I don't think it's imagined that there are a lot of these false notions in the church, and it just becomes difficult to be the one who is correcting this, you know.
No fun being the grown-up in the room.
Yeah, and also when you're also struggling with other things, you know. So, yeah, I appreciate what's being said.
It's a long process to gain that footing and to learn how to speak and to be an effective change agent. So I totally get you, brother. And I think people know a little bit about my story. There was about 4 years where I couldn't even take it half the time, you know. So I would just stay home lots of weeks, and, you know, it was just know that I've been there with you. Do you guys want to keep talking about daughters and women's stuff, or should we move on to something else?
I'm chomping at the bit for my next question.
Okay, go for it.
No, I appreciate that. So, you know, I know when we were discussing, you know, kind of how we're going to frame this podcast, we, you know, weren't going to go through, you know, all the historical claims of the church and, you know, and everything. And definitely that's not the focus of this question. But I guess the question has more to do with, you know, I guess sitting through lessons, teaching your children, not so much just focusing on children. I know we've done that quite a bit, but specifically the historical, I guess, accounts of the church that we hear in Doctrine and Covenants. Now, I mean, I'm not deeply familiar, Dan, with the Fowler Sages of Faith, other than listening to, you know, you and other people discuss them on podcasts. I'm a little bit familiar with Kohlberg's Stages of Moral Development, so I understand that we don't want to teach, you know, new converts and kids all about, you know, polyandry and, you know, kinderhook plates and all this other stuff. But I guess one of the struggles that I have in maybe living authentically. And I imagine, and I know from other people that are in my situation that I know, but I imagine probably a lot of people that are in my situation, is how do we, you know, how can we just sit there and listen to the accounts of church history that the church provides that, I mean, in my opinion, are not completely honest in the fact that, I guess that we're not, you know, it seems like we're exaggerating certain things. We're clearly not giving full accounts, you know, and even, you know, not saying that we have to teach all of the controversy, but we paint Joseph Smith to be this individual. While we say he was, oh yeah, he wasn't a perfect person, but that's definitely not, you know, we're not painting the image of Joseph Smith that may be the most truthful one. So that might be the hardest part for me personally, you know, to sit through an Elder Scrum lesson about some historical thing and everybody just sits there and I feel like I am, you know, amongst a bunch of zombies and I'm the only one that's not a zombie and nobody else knows what's going on.
Yeah, but you were a zombie just a few years ago.
I know, I was a zombie.
And you didn't feel like a zombie. And yeah. So at some point, yeah, I hear you.
Yeah, so I was like, how do you sit through that? How would I participate in a lesson? How, like I said, I'm teaching primary and I'm thankful that we are teaching the Old Testament and I got called after the Book of Abraham was taught. So I'm in a good zone right now where I don't have to have any of these big moral dilemmas about what I'm going to teach. But, you know, specifically, you know, how can I just sit through a lesson and not just get up and walk out when you hear all of these, you know, Joseph Smith was just this great kid ever since he was a little kid. He didn't want to drink wine, you know, didn't want to drink any alcohol when he had the surgery with the typhoid in his leg. And, you know, you hear this whole thing and, you know, and you hear Truman G. Matson's account of Joseph Smith, which that's what I heard. And I was thinking, oh, Joseph Smith is just amazing. And then, you know, I, like many people, you know, face down the barrel of the more complete truth of, you know, completely face shaken, lost my whole faith in God because I believed in Santa Claus essentially my whole entire life, so literally. And once there was a, you know, I found out about a rock and a hat, my whole life crumbled. So, you know, I don't want to perpetuate that, and I don't want to sit through that, and I don't want to teach my children that either. So how do you do that? Live authentically, teach your children maybe a more robust, less literal history, yet maintain the good Mormon, you know, full-blown Mormonism. And you talk about living the myth, Dan. You say, I live the myth, it's, you know, and I like that, but that's where I shake my fist and say, but no, that's not living authentically. You can't just go and say, oh, Joseph Smith was this great, you know, person and sit through these lessons and contribute, but then just sit there and say, well, I am perpetuating this, I mean, in my opinion, you know, and I think I overall have a very positive view of many of the things of the church, but I just can't help but think that we're not being honest.
So I heard two parts to that question too. One is how do I sit through it? And the other one is how do I teach my kids? Kind of you did that in there too, right?
Not just kids, so, but I mean, what if I'm called to teach an Elder Scrum?
Okay.
I mean,
or right. Okay. So. It's tough, Adam. And what you've hit on was certainly, you know, for my 8 to 10 to 12 years of really active ups and downs and all that stuff, this is, you know, what you're naming here is absolutely, you know, the key things, because once I was on the path of discovery and once I, you know, had some new framings and was aware of different things, it was hard to hear it. And that was partly why I couldn't go for those off and on for those years, because it was just like, you know, I think I even kind of made you guys laugh a little earlier in the podcast when I was trying to imitate, you know, what was going on in my head. Can't you guys see? You know, that kind of stuff. And it really, really is hard. But, you know, with time came skill, and how I screwed up when I, you know, when I talked with the bishop, and that really led to the thing with my son and not being able to ordain him. It was because of my lack of skill in sort of learning how to convey the nuance. But, you know, I do, I teased you a little bit before, you know, I kind of interrupted you for part of it. There is this point in our own lives where all the people that are frustrating us were once us. We bought it hook, line, and sinker. Not that it was like, it's not like we're selling us a bill of goods kind of thing, but we were inside the myth fully. We, you know, every positive reading of church history that we'd get, we'd eat it up and think that's the one. We, you know, kind of had this vague sense of where anti-Mormons or those that are enemies of the church or somehow or other, you know, we'd find some little thing where they've got it wrong, and so we've assumed that everything that they teach is wrong. And we were totally, you know, exactly where you're kind of universalizing and saying where you think everyone else is. Well, at some point, you know, we made the change. And we're still deciding to stay. We're wrestling in ourselves. And so slowly but surely we can learn to share that, you know, I know that faith isn't in Joseph Smith. I don't have faith in the Book of Mormon. I have faith in the God that Joseph Smith helped me teach about. Or I have faith in, you know, the God that this book of Scripture points to. You know, my heart's been changed. My soul's grown. However we want to put it, if we can convey that at any time, that we're also helping somebody, you know, see that, you know, don't hang your hat on that Thomas Marsh story in the milk strippings, please, you know, because if you're going to look at that really hard, I promise you, folks, you're going to find, you know, some difficult Mormon history in there, you know, that kind of thing. And after a while, as long as we're able to kind of, you know, convey the faith where it's supposed to be placed, and we can share that, you know, I've pretty well learned the last few years, and Nylan can kind of say what her strategies are, as long as I simply say, you know, the way, if it's a teaching that's going down the wrong direction, I'm going to say, you know, the way that teaching sings best to me is this, and then I'll share an insight, and pretty much, guess what, usually the discussion goes my direction after that, because everyone gets excited, because maybe it's something new, you know, or something they hadn't thought about for a while, or something like that. And so this, how can I sit there, you know, I do it a lot with empathy, because they were me. And then it was just, it kind of came out of my own spiritual growth and my own grounding in what I think is where we're supposed to have faith grounded. It's not in the perfection of Joseph Smith. It's not in the, you know, the process of translation of the Book of Mormon, but it's what these things do to transform our souls. And if we keep that in mind and have that in our hearts, it's pretty easy to be, you know, not, I mean, I still make mistakes. I still overboard and scare people and shut down discussions. But, you know, six out of seven times now, I feel like I manage pretty well, and I think most people enjoy having me around. Nylan, anything, you know, echo or disagree or?
Yeah, I have this strange thing where I actually have more faith in processes that are messy, because I feel like that's more realistic and that's more the way life actually works, rather than to have to suspend all disbelief and believe in something that doesn't have much relevance to my own life. I think of the times when I've experienced revelation in my life and they're sort of just bursts of opening of my mind, or it's, you know, a sort of vision that comes to me while I'm half awake in the early hours of the morning, or it's, you know, a feeling that comes while I'm washing the dishes, or, you know, it's not always like when I'm in the temple and supposed to be doing all those perfect things. And so when I think about something like Joseph Smith, or the way that we received the Book of Mormon, or even the way we've received the Bible, you know, it's much more comfortable to me to think that these things happen in kind of messy ways. And that actually increases my faith, because I think, wow, like, it's so amazing that God can work through these imperfect people and still deliver us the Book of Mormon. Like, I don't care how we got it. I feel when I read it that my mind is opened, not because I'm actually like learning specific things from the stories about, you know, how to live my daily life, but because something in those stories opened my mind to possibilities in my own contemporary life. And
So are you saying you're able to share that at church, that I like the messiness of this people? Or is this just like how you're sitting there, they're telling a clean, idealized version? Or is this just your personal meditation while you're sitting there? Because Adam's all like, how can I sit there?
Yeah, I think, you know, part of me is just like you said, Dan, I think, you know, I don't want to be that person who's always like, who's like, you know, well, wake up, because, you know, what's working for you isn't working for me. There are probably a lot of times that I kind of let things go, because as you said, things are working for those people at that moment, right? But, you know, I feel like but on the other hand, there are times when I definitely will say something. For instance, I think I referred earlier to that, to our recent lesson on Job, when people were saying, well, this was an actual story that, you know, happened, and somebody else was brave enough to say, actually, I think this is just a morality tale, and it's told in a very sort of, you know, formulaic way that might be consistent with Hebrew poetry structure, you know, and I seconded that, and I said, you know, I agree that what we have to look at is, you know, what the story, as I said earlier in the podcast, what this story does for us, not necessarily get detracted, I think, you know, by the debate of did God and Satan actually have a little powwow. But so I think it really would depend. I think I also mentioned previously that there was some lady who, you know, mentioned in my last Relief Society lesson, the girls who wear short skirts are walking pornography. And that one, I was just going to like, well, you know, right. Okay, you know, not much I can do there. But I think there really was for me, you know, I had a sort of this drive to religious studies in high school. And one of the reasons I loved it was because I felt like the people came alive as actual real people. They weren't sort of these perfect cardboard figures anymore. And I did love that. One of the principles that I like a lot, and you all may be familiar with it, is this principle of inoculation that Terrell Givens talks about. Terrell and Fiona both talk about this idea that, and I strongly believe this, that if you, you know, come to a 30-plus-something-year-old man and you say, did you know Joseph looked into a hat and, you know, translated the Book of Mormon through a seer stone, it can be crushing, as you've experienced. But they give this great alternative scenario, which is that you go to a 10-year-old boy and you say, hey, you know, did you know that Joseph Smith looked at a stone and a hat? And it really made sense because, you know, the light was kind of bothering his eyes, and he was going through this long, long process of translating a lot in a very short amount of time, and he was complaining of headaches. And so he put it in a hat to try and block out some of the extra light so he could focus more and not get headaches. And the boy goes, oh, cool. You know?
You know what's funny?
That's just the example the Givens give, and I responded, and that felt right to me when they shared that with me.
Yeah, you know, I've heard the Givens, you know, say the same thing. Actually, we've done that with our son when we were talking about the Book of Mormon, because we were just discussing how it was done, and we kind of laid it out there, and his thought was, wow, I wonder if his neck hurt because he was into that hat. So it was really it was no question, except for that Sunday he said, why does the picture that's hanging in my primary room? Why is it not accurate? So, you know, we have to explain, well, that's somebody's depiction of the whole thing. But I mean, I guess from what I'm hearing is, you know, Nylan, you know, this utility Mormon versus validity Mormon. And, you know, some people, you know, they find the utility in being a Mormon, and that's, you know, kind of where I feel both you, Dan, and you, Nylan, are kind of coming from, is, you know, we go to church and the church is there to build us up and to make us better people and do these things. But, and I also recognize that everybody has to go through earlier stages of faith or, you know, stages of moral development or whatever, where they think very teenage, you know, I think you said in a teenage view, Dan, of, you know,
right,
things are very simplistic. But the fact is at the very top of the, you know, top level, you know, when I was taught by missionaries, I was taught, this is this way, factual, this happened, this happened, this happened. I taught it as a missionary. I came home, I believed it. And then, when I was 22, I saw Joseph Smith, I saw a little gif on the internet of Joseph Smith putting his face in a hat, and all of a sudden my whole world crumbled. And I get how maybe inoculation, might solve some of those problems, but I'm talking more, we stand and we say, if we listen to the fair arguments or whatever, that, there really were elephants, and here's the, we take all of these, crazy, I don't know, maybe they're not crazy. I'm not trying to accuse anybody, but I'm talking about the stance that we're given at church from the leaders of this church is not, is a utility stance, but it is a validity. This is true, or this is a great fraud. There's none of this, we just take the lesson out of it. Maybe we're teaching a little bit not correct, and it's a pious, fraudulent reason that we're presenting this thing in a kind of a dishonest way. But for me to be an authentic individual that, frankly, I was a validity Mormon. I thought, I'm joining this church and going on a mission because this is a fact that Joseph Smith was saved Jesus only. the person that said more than anybody again, with all of this buildup, I don't know if I guess I could have been inoculated in that, but it was all the validity stuff. And, when I'm sitting through that, I don't know. I feel like, especially on the teaching side and even to my children, I don't want to perpetuate this myth that you've chosen to live, Dan, I guess is what I'm saying.
Chosen to live. I mean, the myth of Joseph Smith, something important happened with Joseph Smith. He taught many amazing things that have inspired me. They've sent me on my own dives into the world. That's how I live the myth. I'm not quite positive, the rest. When I'm at church and when I think it's serving faith in God, then I certainly don't generally in my own brain start to pull things, I don't get my bifurcation going and say, this is a bunch of crud. But I'll tell you, my rule when it comes to when do I engage or not, and Nylan, she was saying that there's no saving that pornography, walking pornography thing, occasionally there's something that's so bad, but it's almost every time when I for sure jump in is when it portrays God as a judgmental jerk, lack of compassion, the really horrible readings of, no unclean thing can enter the kingdom of God, as if it's like an offense to God that we screw up or something like that. And that's when I jump in. Or when I jump into somebody saying, that they're beyond the reach of the atonement, I'll be happy to be a ministering angel because, of all my sins and my, stuff like that. I've just got to get in there. But again, what am I sharing? I'm sharing, that Christ got into my heart, that somehow or other through, studying these scriptures or through these stories, I had confidence to go find out from God myself how much I'm loved. And that's if you can say that, man, you've won the whole world. If you've got that in your own heart, there's nothing that church history can do other than, another one bites the dust, and that's disappointing too. But, it doesn't affect the sense of, all the gifts that, having a religious life bring to you. And the fact that I believed that the Book of Mormon was historical, when I went through my big transition process, age 23, age 24, that did help me to think that those guys that I was reading about really lived and stuff like that. And so even as now I'm not so, 100% convinced that it's historical, I was glad to have that certainty, or that real sense that they were historical then. And I don't feel betrayed. I don't feel, of course you have to grieve the loss of idealization, everything, marriage, American history, everything. The more you study it, the more human it gets and things like that. And so there's this grieving process, and we kind of want, if it's the true church, everyone's automatically going to, see the big picture all the time and, really be grounded in it. And it's, grieve it, but be centered yourself and you're all right. You can just move on. What's the thing that I do today to help the situation?
I meant to say, when you've talked about in the myth, it was in the best possible sense of, I view this almost as a parable. And I guess, you know, in, you know, from the sounds of it. And that's what I've gathered from many of your podcasts and you, and, you know, and other people too, that have kind of found themselves on the way on the inside, is you almost have to switch from the validity type of Mormon to the utility type of Mormon. And maybe that's a progression within the stages of faith or whatever to get to that point. But
well,
do you just let go of all of the validity claims altogether?
Validity, as in truthfulness of the claims. See, there's sort of an empiricism that I do claim out of all this, in the sense that, you know, empiricism means you look to experience to, you know, prove or disprove something, rather than, you know, just keep it all in the theoretical realm where it's all, hey, this premise is pretty and that premise is pretty and they add up and so therefore, ooh, we have a nice view. So I'm always wanting to check with reality. And so the validity comes to me in the sense of, like, here's what's happened in my heart. Maybe I'm going to question the ability of that language to fully encapsulate what it is that I'm experiencing. So, you know, all of my spiritual experiences kind of blow away any previous language, just the way our experience of love itself blows away any description of love, or, you know, all the famous ones about, you know, can't describe a taste or something like that. You have to taste it. So, you know, I'm dealing in that kind of realm there, where there's an empiricism that makes it valid to me that, you know, this teaching of the plan of salvation, you know, really, there's something to it. You know, again, I'm not going to say the details, but I'll tell you, you know, pondering that, it doesn't always happen, like Nylan was saying, when she's washing the dishes or something and things come over to her. So it's not always when you're actively in it, but when you're overtaken by a spiritual insight, or when you're, you know that you're in this mode that's somehow different than just, here's another idea that crossed my brain. You know, you get that full encapsulation of, like, I'm on fire here. I've lost my train of thought there, but the validity comes for me in the sense of, you know, that was a good starting point. That was algebra that took me into calculus. That was Newtonian physics, and that works at a certain level, but man, now I'm looking at quantum entanglement or something, where everything's connected and we're into non-dual reality or whatever. I guess I'm just trying to say that, you know, I don't want to, like, claim, I don't want to say that I'm fully utility. I am, like you say, the church is there to serve us. We're not, our life isn't to be sacrificed on the altar of the church. But the church serves us to hopefully give us those weekly reminders, the stories, the encouragement of the scriptures, the ready-made opportunities to serve others, you know, opportunities that just, you know, sometimes you can only learn things when you really give yourself over to somebody else, and especially somebody that's not like you, and you get into a new experience. And so that's its utility. But the validity kind of proves itself just in my own heart, that I'm larger, that I feel grounded, that I feel the significance of life.
I think I really like, personally, that sometimes when you discuss framing it, you know, being in the myth and those kinds of things, the one problem, there's two problems. One is that, generally speaking, when we discuss myths, everyone is aware of it being a myth. And so, you know, it doesn't feel like a fraud. You know, we know it's a myth. The other thing is, I just worry about, and I think I worry about how much we provide cover when those of us who are like, okay, well, we can see beyond this, and, you know, we'll let the church catch up to us. How much are we providing cover for the church for not getting out there and, you know, correcting the story? You know, how much are we at fault for supporting?
Well, you don't think so? All this new movement on the gospel topics, the seminaries and institutes are now teaching multiple accounts of the first vision this year. There was at least one other area that they were doing. I guess you could call it the inoculation that Nyland was talking about earlier. I mean, waiting for them to catch up. We're not just waiting; we're actively helping change the dynamic. And so when you say providing cover as if, like, you know, we're aiding and abetting the enemy instead of being part of the team that's, you know, doing good to help something more powerful emerge in the world. That's my framing on it.
Well, I guess that's one way to frame it. I don't know. Sometimes it feels a little bit to me like when I witnessed my son punch the other son, and I come up and approach the one son, and I say to him, why did you punch your brother? Oh, I didn't punch my brother. And then I have to say, you know, I actually witnessed you punch your brother. And I guess you could say I'm pushing back and clearing and, you know, helping guide things in the right direction. But I'm not sure that, sometimes the church feels like the less like, thank you for bringing this to our attention. Instead, it feels a little bit more like, well, I guess we got to do something about this. Like inoculation, just right. That's the word you use for someone could contract polio or whatever, you know, it's a bad thing, you know, yes, you got to deal with it, but it's a
bad
thing.
Reality. It's reality. You're not a disease. It's just a more historical.
Yeah, it's reality. And so are we just, I don't know, Adam, do you feel sometimes like we're like it's to shape it differently than, hey, perhaps these things were covered up? Do you feel like that sometimes feels like,
I mean,
it's not like we're not really moving the conversation forward. Instead, we're helping to participate in the cover-up? I don't know. Maybe
I mean,
I
feel like that, I guess, a little bit. I mean, I recognize, you know, when I first went through all of this, probably like most people, I was pretty angry for a while, and I'm not angry anymore about it. But I still recognize, you know, I had a conversation with a family member who is an active member, and, you know, he was telling me, hey, you should go, you know, I live here in the Twin Cities area of Minnesota. He's like, you guys got to make sure we get out to Nauvoo, and we haven't. And I was like, yeah, you know, I've been really, you know, hammering, you know, church history and going through this stuff. And then the conversation turned, you know, as far as something. And I was like, I don't literally believe, you know, everything. And he's like, what, you know, the same thing you're saying, Dan, like, what anti-Mormon stuff have you been reading? I mean, and I know it takes, you know, our church, right? They say, well, it takes us 20 years after, you know, everybody, you know, it's supposed to, because things move so slowly.
Well, yeah, you have to get
15 right?
guys to agree.
My son.
You know, that it's time to move. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, well, like, you know, even in from a very nice lady in our ward, you know, who's great, you know, she just gave a talk a couple weeks ago about, you know, part of it was including the Book of Abraham and Abraham's lying on an altar and all this stuff. And my wife, who was the organist, you know, she was up on the stand, and afterwards she went down to talk to my son, and she's just like, I don't want to perpetuate this. I don't want this view that, you know, is just, that's a microcosm, right? That literally is Abraham. And granted, the church has kind of silently put out these essays, and they're, you know, kind of, you know, they're not coming out with an official thing, you know, that really we've known these issues for decades, and we really aren't changing the dialogue. You know, maybe in 30 years there will be a completely new dialogue, and, you know, we should be grateful that we're moving in that right direction. But I mean, still to this day, you know, I view the 17-year-old me who joined the church, you know, and I recognize maybe I wouldn't have joined the church if I didn't think there was all this mystical power. I don't want to say that, you know, all of this really mystical things that was behind it. And then as I've grown up, all that mysticism has fallen away. And while I actually appreciate our faith much more because of the complexities, after I've learned all of this stuff, I can't help but feel that, gosh, I look at my son, I look at all these other people, and I say, man, these people are in for a rude awakening when all this really, something's going to happen, and these people are just, you know, and if it wasn't for the internet, our church wouldn't even be telling us any of this stuff, right? So, you know, and I try not to perpetuate my own faith journey onto other people and say, okay, now that I know something, everybody has to know that, but I still can't, it doesn't feel super authentic to just sit through it and just hear something that to me doesn't ring, that isn't factual or isn't a statement just so that we're building up people's faith so that they, you know, because the church is a net good, let's just teach them all of the positive ways that it can be and not really have a problem with it and be grateful that the church is, you know, releasing some essays silently on a couple of things and hopefully they release another essay here or there and then I'll have some proof to go talk to my family member and tell them, hey, I'm not just listening to anti-Mormon stuff. The church is putting it there too, you know?
Yeah. Nylan, do you want to jump in at this point or else I can keep going with these guys?
Real fast, Dan. I also will say I have, in fact, pointed a few people to the church's new statement. And they're hesitant. They almost behave like there's anti-Mormonism now being put on the church's website. You know, they are very hesitant to hear.
That's human nature. We'll kick and scream. And have you guys read Thomas Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolutions? It happens in science. It happens in every field. That it's very, very slow, these paradigm shifts, and they're painful. We give up certainty, and at some point, you know, you begin to like the adventure of it all, but that's tough stuff. And you certainly don't want to send people there but who aren't kind of opening, you know, you can kind of sense, you know, I think in church you're always safe to speak up and say, this is how this strikes me, and then to give a very positive framing. Or this is, whenever I think of this doctrine, here's how I go. And you're always safe to do that. But in terms of just generally, you know, somebody who comes to you, you'll can read the signals of when they're ready for a little bit more. And the more prepared we are, the more, you know, grounded we are in both the facts as well as God or whatever it would be, the more successful we're going to be and the easier it is.
But doesn't some of that just speak to the, you know, the very human nature of the church?
I'm grateful for I know the church is human.
Yeah, I mean, I know the church is human too, but that's not the way it, that's not how it's often being conveyed, you know. The brethren are divine first and human second, not human first and divine second. Hey, Dan, I mean, people come to you because they know you recognize that, but no one who doesn't also feel that way, I don't think is going to be like, oh, wow, Dan just totally opened my mind after that. You know, I don't know. I'd really like to hear from Nylan at this point because I feel she's like on middle ground on some of this.
Nice.
I mean, I guess my thoughts about this stem from an appreciation of something I referenced earlier, which is this, that we are truly the only, you know, vibrant faith right now in the world that has a functional global organization that's run by the members. Really, Catholicism is the only one that I think rivals us in our productivity and our global community. But of course, they have a paid clergy, and this idea has been brought home to me several times in my work, where we try to do some interfaith projects, and the fractured nature of so many other denominations really sort of bears witness to me that, you know, even though the people working in the structure are, I believe, human first and divine second, the structure itself, the ability to bring a community together across the globe in what is today an unfractured community, you know, in the sort of designations of orthodoxy and membership and all of that, I think is that to me does speak to the divinity of the organization. That from the very start, there has been a system of government put in place that allows this growth. That's very exciting to me. That said, I mean, I really sympathize with something that was said earlier about the mysticism that seemed so prevalent in the early church, and I struggle with that. Why do we not have that same same practicing of the spiritual gifts as they did in the early church, and why, you know, do we talk about angels today in terms of your visiting teacher rather than, you know, literal spiritual beings that are walking by our sides? And I wish that there were more mysticism. I wish that there were more manifestations of truly divine power. There's absolutely no doubt that I desire that. But I guess, you know, I kind of have to turn to my own experiences and, you know, the miracles and manifestations that I've seen in my personal life to sort of buoy me up in that regard.
I appreciate that. And I think, you know, that's kind of how I have, for me personally, my faith journey fell off the tracks and stuff because of a lot of these issues. And I kind of find myself working back in because I say, hey, I feel something here. I don't know I don't know about all this mystical stuff that we've heard in the past and we don't really see today. And that's where I'm at. I guess, you know, maybe to move to on the second part of the question, because I want to be respectful of everybody's time on this, is maybe you, Dan, or you, Nylan, if, you know, you're up there teaching a gospel doctrine lesson or some type of Sunday school lesson about the Kirtland Temple dedication and the visitation, right, of Moses, Elias, and Elijah, just as an example, and we don't have to delve into that whole issue. How do you frame that and just put it in the CES material, or are you going to, you know, try to take away some of the mystical things, try to give, you know, somebody else's perspective, David Whitmer's account of what happened or something like that? Are you going to really try to stay away from some of that mystical stuff, or are you going to try to lay it out, you know, and say, oh, there, you know, alcohol and all this other stuff that happened there? I mean, you know, that probably wouldn't be appropriate at church, but, you know, if I was asked to give that lesson, you know, not to people in primary, I wouldn't be going into some of those things. I don't know what I would teach and feel honest about it, I guess.
I think sometimes in those situations, a really interesting conversation can ensue if you ask, what do other people think, you know? I don't, you know, and I think the skill there would be, of course, in the way that you handle the conversation, but I think giving people an opportunity to express their trust in the literalness of the story is important, and also it gives people an opportunity to express, you know, hopefully in a safe space, their belief in the non-literal elements of it. I don't know. I've never personally had an experience that I could point to with that, but it might be an interesting experiment.
Yeah. I wouldn't feel like I was forced to come, you know, by any, no matter what the lesson material would say, you know, I'm never going to be forced to teach something that I don't believe or I don't think has a positive, you know, possible effect or framing on it. And so, you know, if I were doing Kirtland, for instance, I'd probably, let's look back at the day of Pentecost and, you know, let's look back at other big events and things like that where lots of people have, you know, King Benjamin's address or whatever we'd want to kind of just and put it in a framing of saying, you know, what was happening here? You know, beautiful truths were being taught. People came with general faith. They approached, you know, humbly, probably with fasting and prayer. You know, it was a special time in things like this, and so because of their openness and their expectations, things happen. How many times in our lives do we say no to spiritual experiences because we feel like we're not deserving of them? Or, you know, why would God want to talk to me? You know, I could see having a really good experience that way, but I wouldn't feel like the necessity of doing it.
Yeah, I think, like, this is where I'm at with the perpetuating, and I hate to harp on it, I guess. It's more like, you know, even if I wanted to put a positive, you know, spin on it, I don't want to have to sit there, and people don't come to church to hear all these crazy stories that are not faith building. And I completely recognize that. I guess the problem is, you know, should I say, you know, there were people that had no, you know, accounts. Should I actually say, you know, Oliver Cowdery, Joseph Smith went behind this curtain, you know, this veil that dropped. I mean, like, the things that you don't...
Do you know that there wasn't any major spiritual manifestations for real there?
No, I mean, but I know, I mean, you know, and you could give people a, you know, again, not, you know, harp on any one specific issue. I mean, I guess saying with that issue, you could say there were a lot of people that had a lot of accounts that were written down. There were also some people that didn't. Like, so I wouldn't want anybody to go there and say, you know, walk away from a Sunday school lesson that I thought and said, wow, that experience was 10 times more magical and mystical than it probably really was. It was just what it was, you know, some people said that they had some experiences. A lot of people didn't, you know. You don't have to teach that ever, you know, there's people probably drunk, or you don't have to go through that whole thing. I'm guessing you wouldn't do that, but I just don't want to perpetuate this mystical thing that's going to build up this story that then kind of is just like, wow, that's really so far exaggerated from probably the actual account. And for me, I actually think, you know, the actual account may be much more, you know, considering all sides, it's so much more believable and so much more human that I almost appreciate it more. But if I, you know, I was built up on the fluffed up story, when you find out the whole history, the more accounts of that, you're just like, what? It wasn't that magical? And what is this? You know, you just have the, it's depressing. And I don't want to perpetuate that, you know, and that was just an example of any number of types of things that you go through.
I'd like to quickly share an actual experience that sort of related to this. You know, we were discussing the Kirtland period in Elderscorn, and, you know, I wanted to be positive. We were discussing, you know, how everyone was turning against Joseph Smith, and I thought, well, I got a sort of a positive spin I can put on this, but also sort of, you know, help people to see that there's more going on here other than that Joseph Smith is not, other than that he's just this constantly persecuted person because he's, you know, always right, and that, you know, Satan of course hates the right. And I said, you know, well, you know, we should probably go sympathize with, we could probably sympathize with, right, the brethren who were feeling cheated by the prophet, you know, and maybe we could even take some comfort in this or take a lesson in this ourselves, you know, when maybe we feel inclined after the prophet does something very human and you know, that we might be inclined to, you know, maybe say that he's not receiving revelation. And then there was this sort of turn of, what are you talking about? Oh, well, you know, because Joseph Smith had started this bank and he had maybe, you know, he had started this bank and perhaps he maybe used his power just a little bit to influence people to, you know, get involved with it. You know, maybe that was his human moment and he forgot to declare to people that he's acting human at this moment and not divine, you know. And, you know, there was, I must say, it pretty much silenced the class. And I know for certain, I wasn't saying something that was untrue. And in fact, I wasn't even saying something that is disputed by, you know, historians within the church. And it kind of fell like a lead weight. So it doesn't always work out quite like you might hope.
No, it definitely doesn't always work. We learn by trial and error, don't we? How much we can push the envelope, for sure. Yeah, Nylan, anything here?
I don't. I guess I'm just more. I think I'm a little bit more fluid on this subject. I guess I would go. I've been really excited about the gospel topics. Things that are coming out of the Church History Library, and I think they were described earlier as kind of being released silently, and I actually don't think that they have been silent. I think that, you know, one of the things that we struggle with and you know, we'll navigate our way through is this idea that we don't have necessarily this official canon, or that if we do, it comes through our CES manuals, you know, and I think that, you know, there has been some frustration that the communication channels, primary communication channels, are public affairs and the church history library. But I also think that, you know, that the significance of those two departments means that stuff that comes out of the church history library, like the gospel topics pages, you know, I know those go through really robust approval processes, and I think that we should be really encouraged that those are being heralded as sort of not necessarily a canon, but a real resource that is being posted on the canonical site, LDS.org. And I don't know, I think that that's been a really exciting development, and I think it's a really exciting time because, you know, I think the Church History Library and the leaders that oversee that are recognizing that there's no turning back with the internet. There's no turning back, you know, holding the finger in the dike of the flood. And I think that there's been an embrace of that with the extraordinary growth in influence and size of the Church History Library over the past 10 years.
I agree with that. And also, I really think that half the brethren are learning this for the first time in the last few years themselves. You know, so these topics that are getting there, I can imagine a good chunk of the general authorities, because they go through the same training and classes that we do growing up. And unless they're readers and actively interested in history and things like this, they just don't know this stuff themselves. And so in some ways, I have a little bit of sympathy for them, you know, having to go through an adjustment period themselves and then getting them all to agree. But on the gospel topics thing, my understanding is, well, first of all, this week there was a 3-paragraph release that at least we found on the internet that was sent to bishops and stake presidents and stuff talking about the gospel topics, and these as a resource for those who are struggling within your ward. So I know there's that. And then my understanding is when all 12 come out, that they have planned that there might be a letter from the pulpit or something that will do it. So I can see why, if you've only got 7 of your 12 or 8 of your 12 or whatever there is by now up, that you'd kind of wait, you know. Plus, we know that we've heard through John's podcasts, and I've heard anecdotally, you know, in other groups that I'm gather with, that there have been people that have actually been thrown by the blacks and the priesthood one because of that whole, you know, admitting there was pretty clear there was huge cultural factors influenced the church leaders, and they got it wrong, and, you know, of course their language was cleaner than that, and, you know, more wishy-washy. I'm sure not everybody loved it, but that's really thrown a lot of members for a loop. So in some ways you would kind of, you know, want to leave those things as when they're ready to discover that, then it's there.
Oh, I guess we may be heading towards wrapping things up, but I think this falls in line with everything we've been talking right now. And you know, I was feeling very positive. I was kind of feeling when I first, before earlier this summer, I was feeling like, well, you know, there are all these challenging things in the church, but then there's also these people, right? There's these people like John DeLynn. There's these people like Dan Witherspoon who are discussing the hard subjects and they're being very honest about it. You know, the excommunication stuff happened. And I just wonder, you know, I don't know why it is that we can't be allowed to discuss these things, you know, like why, I know we don't want to destroy people's faith. And this was a conversation I had constantly with I've had constantly with my bishop, you know, well, where is the place to have these conversations? But how? There has to be a place where someone can dissent and not also feel like they lose their place in the community. And it, to me, it feels a little bit like your place in the community is at risk right now. If you,
yeah.
And that they could send a message, which is that we don't necessarily agree with you, but you're still a part of our community. But I'm not sure that that's the message that's being sent. So I don't know if anyone even wants to talk about that, but.
Well, I'm not sure that the the three-hour block is ever going to be the ideal spot for this kind of stuff. I do think that the ideal thing for that is, you know, singing, focus on Christ, partake of the sacrament, think about your life, have that weekly ritual of, you know, moving into the mode of this day is different than other days. This is when I think about, you know, because I'm able to quiet the rest of the world a little bit more on this day. So I like Sunday to be not necessarily full of tension, but absolutely that we can make a difference and have much wider discussions at church. But again, it takes people that have found their grounding and found their way, you know, through the complexity to where you guys are on the verge of, you know, being ready to teach this stuff, you know, to be that witness in the, you know, pews and, you know, on the welfare assignments and all that stuff of look at this person and I trust that their heart's right. I trust that they have real and genuine faith and, you know, they can then hear you a little bit on some of these stuff. But, you know, to try to schedule it in, I don't know that we can do it. I'll let you know, Brian Dillman just reached out to me about doing a podcast exactly what you were just talking about, Jefferson, of how can we, you know, Abby Isom spoke on the Doug Fabrizio radio show here. It's called Radio West and it was in response to the Kate Kelly thing, and she's saying we can have these great discussions. We have these great discussions all the time, even in my own ward, you know, about these issues. And so Brian says, let's have a podcast on you know, how to have more productive, robust discussions at church. So know that I'm kind of planning that. It's you know, probably weeks and weeks away, but I'm at least open to pursuing that with Brian.
Yeah, well, and also her comments about the tone. I mean, I think that the church were behaving maturely itself. It would say, we're happy to hear the question no matter what the tone is. We're not going to limit you because of your tone. You know, I don't turn to my child.
But on Sunday?
I agree. Sunday probably should be, I'd almost rather eliminate church history just for that fact. But let's just talk about positive stuff where there's for sure positive. But you know, there just has to be a, you know, frankly, the ordained women movement was about as polite in their approach as someone could possibly be. If that's not the tone you can take and say something contrary to the church, then, you know, I don't know that there is a tone you could take. But, you know, I know that's not what happened. The comments section of the Salt Lake Tribune and the Deseret News had to say about it.
No, never look in comments of newspapers.
Yeah, no, I know. Comments are a set full of humanity. I realize that. But yeah, no, it's just unfortunate because I would say even when I was very, very believing, it's almost a total TDM, I still though had things where I kind of like to say, you know, we could do this or we could do that better. And it, you know, it's still for a lot of people, it feels like if it's different, you're starting a fight and it doesn't matter if you're not starting a fight. So yeah, but that's human nature and it's not necessarily just the church's problem, but you would like to see, I would really like to see more what I would consider I don't want to say adult, but more divinely driven responses to criticism of the church and not the ones that we're getting. But yeah, sorry. That could be my wrap up if you'd like.
Okay.
No, yeah, Dan, there,
yeah,
gonna,
yeah, yeah, I know yeah, we need to go. We all need to end. So do you want to either respond to that or do you want to like have a closing, you know, parting thought, Nylan?
Yeah, I would just say that I think my parting thought, let's see. I think my spiritual journey has really been about focusing on the things that enhance my relationship with God, not necessarily because they are the right way to practice things, but because I feel the effect of them on me. I feel an effect when I read the scriptures, even when I'm reading the Old Testament, some random thing. I feel that effect on me, and I feel the effect of being part of a global worldwide community, and I feel the effect of the truthfulness of some of the eternal doctrines. And I those things have sort of crystallized in me to a place where, you know, rather than the sort of broad underpinning of coal, they're kind of like a refined diamond at this point. And I treasure those things, and I have witnesses that they are true, that have been powerful experiences and feelings. And you know, I struggle every day, as I think all of us do, with the way that the divinity that is in the church organization is played out. And that's why I think I've targeted really my efforts on what I think is the most rich, fertile field for improvement, which is each one of us and the experience that we create for ourselves and others at the local level. Because I think, you know, that's where Christianity plays out. That's where Christian compassion and patience and understanding play out. And I think as the church grows, each one of us is coming to terms with the fact that, you know, either institutionally or personally, there's really no way for us to gather in a virtual Zion without some of those, you know, essential Christian characteristics of compassion and to flexibility and an appreciation for diversity, which isn't disunity. You know, those two are very dissimilar and oftentimes get confused that if somebody is diverse from us, they are not loyal to us, which I think is a false argument. And so, you know, my efforts with the Mormon Women Project and with the book are really about shifting this whole perspective that we've been talking about from the black and white absolutism of the institution to the beauty of the individual shaping, the individual deliberateness of our choices. And that really is at the heart of my testimony. And I feel that in all of that, the institution is benefiting me and providing me the scaffolding that I need in order to develop that personal relationship with God. But I see that it can be a hindrance for other people, and it, rather than the scaffolding, it ends up being sort of, you know, the entire foundation. And when that is challenged, it can be devastating, as you've experienced. And so, you know, even though I don't think that I would ever characterize myself as having a faith crisis, certainly my work has taught me that it is real in many lives, and I think that conversations like this will help us develop more of that compassion and help us develop that flexibility that I think is really essential for a global growing church to continue to thrive.
Thank you. Thanks for being on. If you've got to run, we'll let you go. But
okay.
And I'll close up with these guys another 5 minutes here or something. But thanks so much, Nylan.
Thank you, Nylan.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Hope it was so helpful. Thanks. Good night.
It's fantastic. Thank you. Goodbye. All right, Adam, do you have some wrap up kind of stuff?
I feel privileged, frankly, to be. To be able to discuss this thing, you know, I think maybe similar to Jefferson's, you know, his comment that, you know, I think a lot of us don't know where to go to kind of discuss some of these things. I think I'm grateful that I have a, you know, a father-in-law who's pretty open and he's very faithful. But, you know, I think to have these kinds of discussions, there almost isn't an appropriate place where it's more of a, of an open-minded thing. Like, how can I be authentic when maybe when you're at church, the way to be authentic when you might hear from a leader is to just pray harder, you know, and to really gain a testimony of this stuff. And I think sometimes I think, okay, I've gone through my faith crisis and I'm on the other side of it and I want to be in, but I mean, in reality, I'm still, you know, working out how I can move forward. And I think maybe that's just going to be a battle, and maybe that's the way it is for everybody. And I just don't see that, you know, how can I keep pushing forward? But, you know, for me personally, I feel, you know, I choose to believe in God, and I think I feel something there in Mormonism. I am certainly drawn to our church, despite all of the historical issues that I've run into, despite all of the cultural issues that maybe I or others have. And I almost appreciate our church and our theology more the more human it's become. And I appreciate, you know, that's, I think, frankly, Dan, why I reached out to you. I've never reached out to anybody about some of this stuff is, you know, you have this view that's literal. And I listen to that. And I mean, not literal, I mean, like a human, you know, not mystical of Mormonism. And I think about that and I just say, yeah, that's why I love Mormonism and I love our church. And, you know, I think I chose to be a Mormon for a reason, and I'm going to continue to choose to do that. And I mean, maybe all I have is a little bit of a soft nudge, you know, from some higher power that I choose to accept in, and I find that nudge in Mormonism. But I appreciate and feel privileged to be able to participate in this conversation with you and Nylan. And I also would like to endorse Nylan's book. From what I've read so far, I just think this dialogue of inclusion and when I hear bits of this, I'm so drawn to it. And I guess I don't feel that all the time at church, and maybe that's more me than other people. And I obviously recognize I've got to cut people more slack, and, you know, I've got to have my own faith journey, and it can be personal. But when I hear these things coming from a faithful member like Nylan, or you know, hear some of the stuff that you put out there, Dan, I think, to me, I say that's why I like Mormonism, is I feel at home in this framework. And so, you know, hopefully I continue to push forward with that.
Well, thanks for being on, and thank you, Jefferson. Man, loved you guys. This has been so much fun for me, and I'm really glad that you both happened to email within a few days of each other and it occurred to do this. It's such a journey, you know. I talk about journeys all the time here, and I don't want to, like, you know, where is everybody on their journey? But if we just take it on as a journey, that just is such a helpful framing to me. And you know, and I know I trend like I'm young. I'm not young. I'm 55 years old, you know. And when I was in my 30s, like you guys, forget it, you know. You guys are just echoing the things that I said to Randy Paul and the screaming and not that you've been screaming or screeching or being anywhere, you know, but, you know, I mean, in that metaphorical way of just, like, you know, bemoaning and grieving out loud for why aren't we better? Why aren't we more advanced as a church, as a people? And, you know, the only thing that is, you know, part of the thing that helped me was studying other world religions and seeing that every faith tradition, you know, we tend to always want to look at the best of somebody else's against the worst of ours, you know. I mean, there's the famous Kirstar Stendhal thing that says we're often looking at the best of ours against the worst of theirs, but I think sometimes when we're in the middle of our faith crisis, we want to look and say how much worse than we are than everybody else. But I'll tell you, every religion, no matter how transcendent and wonderful and beautiful their teachings are, and we may be drawn to them or something like that, human beings live those at all the levels that we're seeing here. And that's why I like Fowler. That's why I like this idea of we as individuals, as we mature, as we grow, I'll tell you, you know, as we have experiences with the Spirit, seriously, whatever you want to call it, you know, those moments where we just let our framings, you know, be permeable or something like that. And there's this chance for, did one of you guys call it a soft nudge? Yeah, I think it was you, Adam. Just kind of, you're getting these little nudges or things like that. I remember that period of just little nudges, you know, 6 weeks of terror and anger. And then like, it's going to get better, you know, or, oh, that was worthwhile. you know, or things like that. Those are the kinds of things that happen. And, you know, to whatever degree you guys are, you know, appreciators of Mormon Matters and the people that we have on here and things like that, just know that nobody started out that way. But also have compassion for yourself. Have compassion for your old selves when you were true believers and bought it the way that we, you know, are saying that we think that so many people around us do. And have compassion for yourself now to be in the question and to be all over the place and to have good days and bad days. And just know that there's not a single experience that I've had that have shared anything about God that makes me think that God isn't anything but delighted with us at every stage of our lives, because, you know, we're moving, we're discovering, we're shaping ourselves, and, you know, no matter whether your journey is inside or Mormonism, whether you guys stay or go or things like that, as long as you're moving and, you know, and hopefully not settling for smaller framings just because they can be, you know, seen in the laboratory, or maybe that they're born out with some kind of, you know, more easily measurable empiricism. You know, learn to trust the empiricism of our own hearts. Learn to trust the breath that, you know, I don't want any of this to sound like it's just emotion. I've had emotional experiences and I've had spiritual experiences, and there's a qualitative difference, and that difference is in how long they affect me, how long they last within me. Do I feel expanded? Do I feel bigger? And, you know, I think there's plenty of things within Mormonism that make me feel bigger, but, you know, I'm with you guys. 9 out of the 10 things that happen on Sunday, you know, the way they're presented, they don't do that. So sometimes when I'm not in the mood to kind of contribute, I'll ponder those things myself and maybe get a little bit of a boost out of it. Usually when I go, I want to participate, and I'm usually able to find a way into, you know, to be my authentic self and to broaden the discussion. And, you know, it feels like I have a role to play within Mormonism. I know I'm playing it in this, you know, kind of progressive online blogger knackle, you know, podcasting community and things like this. But, you know, I'm finding that at church, I find it with my home teachers. You know, a woman came and told me the other day that she has a person she visiting teaches who's struggling, and she's wondering if I'll come meet with her. So, you know, there's just these little things that kind of will happen to you where you guys will feel important and welcomed, you know, not by everybody because you're going to be scary. But the more that you gain that authenticity for yourself within the church, man, it just works great. So I'm encouraging the heck out of you guys to stay in the battle a little bit longer if you're willing.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Dan. I really appreciate what you do. And I really appreciate the call to be better people, you know, even if it doesn't necessarily mean better Mormons, if that makes any sense.
Well, dudes, thanks so much. This has just been so much fun. I am really, really glad that we ended up doing this, and I hope the listeners will love it. And we'll look forward to your comments, listeners. Please go to MormonMatters.org and share any thoughts that you have about this podcast, where these guys didn't push hard enough, or you know, just where the answers or just the different thoughts that we shared don't track for you. Or please share something that does track for you that neither Nylan or I mentioned. Let's just continue the discussion at MormonMatters.org. While you're there, please donate to the podcast. It's super, super welcomed and thankful, and it makes a big difference in my life when you're able to share that way. And it's encouraging, but it's also a big part of my financial stuff. So thank you. Thank you. Guys, appreciate you very much. You were amazing.
Thanks for having us, Dan.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. I appreciate that.
Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.